On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food's Thanksgiving Show.
You know, probably since I was 20, I would show up at my family's house either the night before or the morning of Thanksgiving, and I would spend the next basically 24 hours to 12 hours cooking all the food and getting it ready, and everyone would help. But I have this extremely high expectation of, you know, brining the turkey and roasting it properly and having the stuffing and everything ready all at the same time. And there I am working off of like four burners and one electric stove, you know. And so about 4 years ago, you know, my sister and I decided to take a different approach.
Thanksgiving. Hey, it can be a bit of a slog. Even professionals struggle with getting everything to the table hot at the same time the guests are ready to eat. But David Lefevre is here to tell you that there is another way. The chef owner of MB Post, Fishing with Dynamite, and the Arthur J. in Manhattan Beach has forged a new kind of brilliant tradition.
So what we do now is we get up in the morning and everybody has their coffee on Thanksgiving. Everybody has a coffee and maybe some toast and kind of muddles around in their bathrobes and just relaxes. And then what I do is I do a huge seafood boil. And we have it between 11 o'clock and 1 o'clock. And all it is, it's one big pot of you know, flavored stock that I had that has, you know, onions and carrot and fennel and spices. And what we do is we just, you know, we drop in the lobster, which takes about, you know, 8 minutes to 10 minutes. And then we drop in some shrimp, and then we drop in some king crab legs, and then some pieces of salmon. And it already has potatoes and corn in there and some linguica. And then we strain it, and we line our picnic table on our deck with a tablecloth that has some sort of protectant in it so it doesn't spill everywhere. And we dump it, you know, we drain the court bouillon out, and we actually have the seafood on the table with drawn butter and cocktail sauce and all these different sauces that we can just sit there and get our hands dirty and have fun and pick at it and drink champagne. And that's what we do in the morning. But the key thing is the night before, I've cooked all of the Thanksgiving dinner, the turkey, the stuffing, the mashed potatoes. I've cooked it all, you know, one dish at a time if I have to, because I only have one small oven in my place, and we refrigerate it. And so we have this wonderful seafood boil during the day. And then 4 hours later, when everybody's watching the football game, hanging out, everybody just starts taking our Thanksgiving leftovers and starts making their plates. And it's really funny because people actually enjoy that more, we found, than they do doing all the cooking and having everybody get together at the table all at once and having 1 hour of, you know, 16 hours of prep for 1 hour, 1.5 hours of dinner.
I mean, what everybody loves the best is the picking.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We found that, you know, you'll have one person that just loves stuffing and they'll start out with a bowl of stuffing. And then you'll have one person who's just eating the mashed potatoes and gravy. And then you'll have someone who's putting a plate together of all the leftovers just like they would normally do it. And then you'll have, you know, one person who'll just walk in and be like, I'm making a turkey, you know, stuffing sandwich. And everybody's just going back and forth, and you find you just, it's a little less stressful. And that probably has more to do with our family than it has to do with the process. But what it does for me is it lets me, you know, really focus on spending time with people. You know, Thanksgiving is a food holiday, but really it's about being with people you love and being able to spend as much time with them. And me too, being able to spend that time with them, not just them having the great time, but me as well.
And that Norman Rockwell painting that is embedded somehow deep in our psyches, no matter where we came from, no matter what kind of family we have, in so many ways is so not truly reflective of how we like to eat or even gather mm-hmm. these days. There's something about being confined to a table mm-hmm. that is just confining.
Yeah.
And if you can get up and watch the game, move over to another part of the house, if it's a beautiful day, go outside for a bit, and you can spin through different groups of everyone mm-hmm. in the gathering. It's so much of a richer experience.
Yeah, and we've also found that when there's kids, it's not like the kids are sequestered and the family sequestered and you have the kids table and adults table. And what we found is just the Thanksgiving, the traditional Thanksgiving meal, people really enjoy just picking apart it more and just taking three or four trips back to the kitchen and loading up on the green bean casserole. And, I don't finish the dish entirely. So, like, we do caramelized Brussels sprouts with some Emmental cheese and balsamic. So we make sure that, I just do the Brussels sprouts and then we have the people put the cheese and the balsamic on, just have that out and they can add that at the last minute. So it's still really great quality stuff, but it's really fun. People really have the first time they experience it, they're a little bit kind of like caught off guard. But if they get to have if they're there for the seafood boil and then later on, they're like, they know the whole time they're still going to have their Thanksgiving meal kind of at their pace. It's really been fun.
So I have to talk to you about the sandwich because when I think about Thanksgiving leftovers or having that kind of spread, I think about what I would want to do.
Mm-hmm.
After I had my initial, and this is going to just seem weird to people, because I'm the one person who always needs to have salad on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, you are weird.
There's something about looking at all that food that what it does to my brain is I just want something really fresh and crunchy. But I want to have mashed potatoes and gravy like on top of my salad.
Right, yeah.
So after that initial bowl of that I would have to get that out of the way, I would want to construct a sandwich.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
So do you find that people sort of get into a space while they're watching the game that there's like sandwich competition?
What I do find is that nobody wants the same bread. Everybody wants a different bread for their turkey sandwich. Some people want whole wheat and some people want like that really kind of Hawaiian, King's Hawaiian type of soft bread. And then there's other people who are like straight white bread, Pepperidge Farm, Some people want dinner rolls. You're like, whatever. So we always try to have a couple of those ready. But mayo is huge too. Like, it seems like everybody has to have mayo on theirs, and it's the combination of the mayo and the cranberry sauce that, like, seal the deal.
Do you have a relish that you always have on the table for people to throw in that sandwich?
Yeah, and it's my sister's recipe, actually, and so me as the chef using my sister's recipe, it's super fun. It's basically cranberries, fresh cranberries, kumquats that you cut in half, get the seeds out, but you leave them halved. There's a little bit of rice wine vinegar, star anise, clove, sugar, and water, and a little bit of orange juice. I mean, the great thing about cranberry relish is you cannot screw. I mean, the only way you could possibly screw it up is maybe by burning it, but even then, that's really difficult, But it's just put everything in the pot, bring it to a boil, let it simmer until they're soft, take it off, chill, and it's done. And it's just got the texture. The sugar and the cranberries have that texture that kind of get that nice gelatinous texture. That's the one I really love. And out here, especially in California, I mean, kumquat, I have a little kumquat tree on my deck. So it's like we can grab the kumquats from there if we want, or it's easy to get them anywhere. And that's not something somebody gets in Milwaukee, So it's fun. It's fun. My sister, she made it for the first time about 8 years ago. And I liked it so much that I actually use it in our restaurants and I use it every Thanksgiving.
That's so nice.
Yeah. Well, our restaurants, the one thing I love about each one of our restaurants is there's something from my family on the menu, whether it's my mother's biscuits or couscous or her squash rolls from Fishing with Dynamite. And we use the cranberry preserve at the Arthur J that my sister did. It's just really, I don't know, when you walk, I think sometimes when you have a business that's also your passion, sometimes the business can get a little bit, you can sway towards the business side a little bit more and the passion can, and so it's fun to come in there and always have something that you grew up with on the menu and that you recognize. And it reminds you of, a time when literally it was just about eating and it was just about the joy of loving to eat and the flavor. So
who are you rooting for?
Oh, the Packers. I'm a huge Packer fan. I mean, when you're born in Wisconsin, you come out, they slap you on the butt, and they say, go Green Bay.
David, what a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
That was Chef David Lefevre. He's the chef owner of MB Post, Fishing with Dynamite, and the Arthur J in Manhattan Beach. We have a recipe for David's kumquat cranberry relish on the Good Food blog. It's also on the Thanksgiving to-go menu at MB Post, alongside those amazing bacon cheddar biscuits. Coming up, the turkey conundrum.
There are some inherent problems with the turkey just by the nature of its physical shape and the way its meat interacts with heat.
how to solve this eternal dilemma, and I'll tell you the one ingredient that will up your gravy game. Stay close.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Foods Thanksgiving Show. It's time to talk turkey. Over the years, we've done the turkey in the pillowcase, the turkey in the deep fryer, the turkey lacquered with 30 herbs and spices. But whatever happened to the classic turkey? You know, the one with the stuffing actually inside, not dressing on the side? Kenji Lopez-Alt, author of the new reference work you'll want to have, The Food Lab, brings us back to the beginning. Hi, Kenji.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. So I have to ask, do you like turkey?
I love turkey. I do.
I do, too.
I don't think we eat it enough. I mean, most people eat it once a year or, you know, maybe in their sandwiches. But no, I love turkey.
And don't you think that's kind of strange? I think we freaked ourselves out because of Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because it's one of those things you cook once a year, I think a lot of people maybe are not particularly great at it. And so you end up having a lot of sort of dry turkey breast at Thanksgiving. And that gives people the false impression that turkey is always dry or that it has to be dry. But it doesn't.
So let's talk about this classic turkey.
Okay.
What is that for you?
Like the super classic turkey, the one like the Norman Rockwell turkey. I mean, that you know, that's the turkey that is presented whole at the table, you know, carved with some stuffing kind of spilling out of it, perfectly golden brown, you know, and ideally you want it to the breast meat to be juicy and the legs to be juicy and the skin to be crispy. It's very rare that it comes out that way.
Yeah, I mean, the breasts cook really fast, and those thighs take forever.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the problem. It's that breast meat is what is called a fast twitch muscle. So it's muscle that's used for like fight or flight situations. So you know, the breast meat is what controls the wings of the turkey. Turkeys don't really fly very often, and so that meat it's very muscular, but also doesn't have a lot of connective tissue. On the other hand, the legs, you know, the turkey walks around all the time. It's slow twitch muscle. It's the muscle that they use all the time, and that muscle tends to have a lot of connective tissue. So you know that, you know, in order for your breast meat to remain juicy, you don't want it to really get much above 150 to 155 degrees or so. On the other hand, the leg meat has to cook to at least 165, 170 degrees in order for that connective tissue to break down. You know, so there's this inherent problem built into every kind of, you know, every bird that you're going to roast. And that's that by the time the legs are done, the breast meat has overcooked. And of course, stuffing a turkey makes this problem even bigger because you now have to take the stuffing all the way up to, you know, 155 degrees. So by the time the stuffing is cooked, the breast meat is far overcooked.
So what do? Do you create an illusion of a bifurcated bird that you stick back together with meat glue?
You can do that. I mean, so first of all, I do recommend if you don't care about how the bird looks coming to the table, I recommend actually spatchcocking it. So taking out its backbone and spreading it out and flattening it because that helps it cook completely evenly because that, you know, that makes it so that the breasts are now the thickest part and they cook more slowly. So your breasts and your legs come out cooking at the same time. But if you want that really classic look, what you basically have to do is boost the energy that's going into the legs. So what I do is I'll use a baking stone or a baking steel, and I'll preheat it in the oven very hot. I'll preheat the oven basically as hot as it can go until that stone is nice and hot. Then I'll lower the temperature of the oven and place the turkey inside it. And that way, there's a lot of stored energy in that stone or in the steel that then gets transferred to the legs, which are much closer to it than the breast is. So that can help really even out the cooking in a turkey when you're using the traditional shape. Of course, that doesn't solve the problem of the stuffing. So what I recommend actually is to line the inside of the turkey with a little bit of cheesecloth, and then you put the stuffing inside it, tie off the end of the cheesecloth so it makes a sort of turkey internal, you're taking sort of like almost a mold of the inside of the turkey, but with stuffing. And then you can pull that bag of stuffing out, pre-cook it. I recommend actually the microwave. You cook the stuffing to 160 degrees, put it back inside the bird, and then throw it in the oven. And you'll find that it actually makes your turkey, first of all, it makes sure that the stuffing is safe. And then it'll also actually help your turkey cook a little bit faster and more evenly. It's not the least messy operation, but it gives you very superior end results.
So do you start with a brined bird?
I don't. So brining is a good safeguard against overcooking. So brining is basically, you know, when you put your bird in salt water, and what happens is the salt will actually dissolve some of the muscle proteins, mainly a protein called myosin. And once those muscle proteins are dissolved, it means that as your turkey cooks, the muscles contract a little bit less, they squeeze out less juice, and your turkey also absorbs some of the water from that brine as it's sitting in there. So you end up with a moister bird, particularly if you accidentally overcook it and your breast meat gets above 150, you know, if your breast gets up to 170, 175 degrees, it'll still be pretty moist when you brine it. There are a couple problems with brining, though. First of all, I find it really unnecessary so long as you're careful with your temperature. But the more important thing is that when you brine it, the turkey absorbs a lot of liquid, and that liquid is just plain water, which is, it tastes watery. So it makes your turkey breasts juicy but less flavorful. And I find that a better way to do it is what I call a dry brine. Some people like to call it a light cure. But essentially what you do is you just salt the bird heavily. And if you're willing to put your hand under the skin, you can salt it between the skin and the meat, and it'll be even more effective. But you salt it and let it sit for a couple days in the fridge. And over the course of those couple days, at first the salt is going to draw some liquid out of the turkey through osmosis. So it'll pull some liquid out, but then the salt dissolves in that liquid, forming a quite intense brine, and that's going to dissolve the muscle proteins in the same way. So the salt is going to sort of work its way down into the turkey meat. Your turkey ends up retaining a lot more of its own juices as it cooks, as opposed to water, and it ends up more deeply and evenly seasoned.
And then do you slather anything or rub anything on the outside of the bird for flavor?
I'm mixed. Sometimes I do. Yeah. Sometimes I like to have like an herb butter, something like that to, give a little bit of flavor to the skin. But sometimes I feel like, just plain old salt and pepper, and let the turkey's flavor speak for itself. You can do it either way. And I do it mixed. Sometimes I do it. Sometimes I don't.
The Food Lab is the name of Kenji Lopez Alt's new cooking tome. We have a recipe for his preferred method, the spatchcocked turkey, on the Good Food blog. Check it out. One of the reasons that Kenji prefers to spatchcock is because of our next topic, gravy. When you cut the backbone out, you can use it to fortify the stock for your gravy. Because remember, a great gravy depends on great stock. We'll get to that in a minute, but Kenji was the first one to share this strange secret ingredient for gravy with me. Marmite.
Yeah, so Marmite is a British sandwich spread. It's a yeast extract, and what it is a very, very concentrated source of glutamic acid, which is an amino acid, sort of one of the building blocks of protein. But it's also the chemical that triggers our sense of savoriness. So in the same way that, you know, acidic things taste sour, sugar tastes sweet, glutamic acid tastes savory.
Kenji may have been the first person to tell me this, but he wasn't the only one this year. Cookbook author Susan Volland is also a fan of Marmite, especially in the vegetarian gravy. Her book, Mastering Sauces, is one of my favorite cookbooks of the year. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Evan.
Okay, gravy. What do we do if we have a vegan at the table?
We embrace them and we welcome them to our table instead of chastising them. But we also offer more than one gravy.
So what is the gravy we would offer to them, and which I'm sure would be co-opted by the meat eaters at the table?
I hope so. I think it's very, very simple. There's absolutely no reason why a vegan gravy is really that much more difficult than a regular turkey gravy. The first place to start is by treating stock like pre-gravy, making something that is complicated and aromatic and deep, and spending a little bit of extra time on that, and then you can thicken it in multitudes of ways.
Okay, so how would we build this stock for our vegan gravy?
I think the number one emphasis is to make it savory and to see if you can make it brown. And the first instinct is to go really with onions and to roast those onions until they're nice and brown like a French onion soup. But there is a little problem with that, in that really roasted onions tend to get very, very sweet. So you can do the roasted onions and some roasted carrots and these wonderful rich flavors, get that brown Maillard reaction, umaminess from them, but then freshen it up with some other fresh ingredients too, like raw onions and raw celery to balance it out. I also think you can add unusual ingredients, like maybe if you do want to go sweet, an apple core or an apple skin, or some charred stems, or lots of dried mushrooms. I think mushrooms are really welcome in a holiday gravy. A little bit of tomato paste. Don't expect it to just be that sort of straight out of the carton vegetable stock. You can really get exotic with your vegetable stock. Another ingredient that I like is Marmite, the English yeast concentrate. I think a little bit of nutritional yeast makes it very chickeny, poultry-y, but still remain vegan. And then you drain and concentrate it just like you would a veal stock or a vegetable stock. It's, you know, or a chicken stock. It's not going to get viscous. It's not going to get that sort of collagen depth to it, but it will continue to get reduced and robust. And then you can thicken it to the consistency that you like.
Okay, so now let's turn our focus to a more traditional Thanksgiving gravy. What are we starting with? Are we starting with the pan juices?
I think we have to back up even a little bit more. I think you need to start with, again, stock. And turkey stock is key. If you're going to make a traditional actual Thanksgiving gravy, you want it to taste like turkey. And so I tend to buy the turkey parts. I look for turkey drumsticks and turkey wings and make a turkey stock several days before Thanksgiving. And then you get to the pan roasting and pan juicings. But there's also another consideration, and that is a lot of people aren't roasting their turkeys anymore. They're deep frying them, they're smoking them, they're brining them, they're doing them on their barbecue. So you don't have that pan juices. But there's still a lot of ways to make great gravy.
So are you roasting the parts that you use to make the stock?
Yes, I do roast those parts. And that's, you can deglaze, you can make a roux, a brown roux in that roasting liquid, and you can save that for your gravy.
Okay, so are we always going to want to thicken a turkey gravy with roux, adding that additional bit of fat, either oil or butter, given that the turkey has so much fat?
Well, I think in the very best turkey gravies, you don't add butter at all. What you do is you use those roasting fats, that liquid from the bottom of the pan. So those drippings, that's going to be the fat that you use. You don't add a lot of butter. You don't do this in a separate pan. You do that right in the roasting pan, and you add just enough flour to make a thin, slightly flowing paste of flour and fat, and then you toast that in the roasting pan until it's golden a little bit, and it picks up some of those sticky, brown, delicious juices, and then you add your stock, and then you simmer that into a lovely gravy. Now, if you don't have a roux, you can still get gravy. You can use a natural thickener. You can use a slurry. For instance, if there are people who are gluten-free, they can use rice flour. They can use a slurry of cornstarch or arrowroot or potato starch. They can use, even in extreme circumstances, you can do an onion or roasted garlic puree. You can use even mashed potatoes will thicken. It won't necessarily be as cohesive, but you can actually thicken sauces with an array of different ingredients.
When I was a kid, my mother would either use a cornstarch slurry or a flour slurry, but sometimes she would use Wondra.
I love Wondra. I think actually, when I was working with the Modernist Cuisine team, that's sort of where I was kind of reintroduced to Wondra. It's a goofy thing. It was always, I know, it was always in the cupboard. It's this sort of cylindrical shaker top, like the old Parmesan cheese. And it was promoted as something you could thicken gravies with by just shaking it over the surface and stirring it in. Because it's so high in starch and because it does work really quickly, it tends to really dim the flavor of your gravy. But if you're in a bind and you need to thicken this right away, sometimes a good old shake of Wondra works. It's a pre-gelatinized starch crystal, so it doesn't have that raw flour taste. And so you don't have to simmer it as long. You don't have to cook it. And it's a kind of a great emergency remedy.
Pre-gelatinized starch crystal.
What, yeah, I sound really like I know a lot.
What is that in English?
Oh, this is information I've been given from experts. I'm not a scientist. This is the stuff that I've learned from a lot of very, very educated people. And that is that to get flour granules to thicken, they soften and they lose starch strands, and that they all bind together, and that hydration of every starch molecule, it gets wet and it becomes gelatinized. Wondra is a product that has already reached that point. It's kind of like it's already been cooked to the point where that has happened, and then it's dried out again and ground up into a powder. So it is never going to really have that raw flour grain taste, which is the selling point of it. And it's, like I said, it's not the best alternative. You can definitely, definitely do better when it comes to gravy, and it's not much more difficult. But it is kind of nice to know that you have that in your cupboard.
Is it wheat?
Yes. I think it's a General Mills product.
Yeah.
And it's been around since, I swear, like the 40s. I think my grandmother used to use it.
Yeah, I mean,
another thing she used to use, I'm sure you remember, is Kitchen Bouquet.
Oh, of course.
So Kitchen Bouquet is that little bottle that was brought out pretty much only on holidays, and only because if the gravy wasn't brown enough, you'd add a little bit of Kitchen Bouquet and make it browner.
Right. And it's basically caramel.
Yeah, basically, but without the sweetness.
Yeah. Susan, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Susan Volland's book is Mastering Sauces. We have a recipe for both her classic gravy and her savory meatless gravy on the Good Food blog. There are a ton of Thanksgiving recipes there. We're also posting them on my Facebook page all week. Just search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. In a minute, our Thanksgiving show continues with Jonathan Gold. Stay with us.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. In the weeks before Thanksgiving, my inbox fills up with diet advice. I can't get over it. One press release promised turkey-burning workouts to work off what you gobble up, while another declared Thanksgiving our national cheat day. It drives me crazy that we're made to feel guilty before we even have the chance to overeat. I've been thinking a lot about celebratory feasting and, God forbid, that word gluttony. So on the occasion of America's only real feasting holiday, I've invited my favorite gourmand, Jonathan Gold, here to muse on the topic with me. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Evan.
Is a gourmand a glutton?
The idea of gourmandism does definitely carry within it resonances of overeating.
And is that what gluttony means to you, like overeating?
I mean, gluttony has more of a compulsion to it, that if you were a gourmet, it means you enjoy the food. If you're a gourmand or a glutton, perhaps it means that you're looking for a 12-step group at some point. And I think gluttony and the idea of the sin of gluttony is not just eating a lot, but it's eating more than one's share. It's eating so much or consuming so much, because gluttony isn't just food, although it's largely associated with food, but it's consuming so much that other people aren't having enough. And that's not happening at Thanksgiving, usually. Although, you know, I'm sure your stuffing is so delicious that somebody wants to take it all for themselves.
I don't know. When I think about you eating, which I actually do more than you might imagine, I think about this duality in your life where often you find yourself sitting at a table without company.
Right.
Surrounded by multiple plates.
Sometimes, yes.
And you're eating and it's your job.
Right. And I don't eat everything on every plate. I have a couple bites of it, which actually in some ways seems more sinful than eating it. There's that conflicting thing. And I must say, my son Leon brings very interesting lunches to school.
I'm sure.
I mean, going to a restaurant alone and sort of contemplating dinner is interesting every once in a while, and there's definitely a place for it. But, you know, the idea of eating is the idea of sharing, of being with people, of being convivial and happy and satisfied together. And does it matter whether somebody has, like, 14 chips instead of 6? I mean, probably to their physician if you do it every night for, you know, 20 years, but not on Thanksgiving. Though, who has chips on Thanksgiving?
I was about to say I would really like to have chips on Thanksgiving. So let's get down to cases. You're cooking this year for Thanksgiving, yes?
I am.
Is there something new you're bringing into your repertoire, or are you relying on old standards?
I haven't quite decided yet, but I'm pretty sure I'm going to do more or less what I usually do. So there'll be, you know, the pan-roasted Brussels sprouts, and there'll be the, you know, apple sausage stuffing with chestnuts. There'll be turkey. There'll be the mashed potatoes. There'll be Russ Parsons' mom's cranberry sauce.
Of course. That will find its way to many tables, I'm sure.
It's not Thanksgiving without Russ Parsons' mom.
Yeah.
Will I do cream leeks again? Probably. It's strange in a certain way, right? Because I don't crave creamed leeks. The rest of the year, I wouldn't think of making creamed leeks. Creamed leeks aren't even really associated with Thanksgiving, except for one year I decided to make them because they were so good as a sub-recipe in a Paula Wolford thing I was doing that I didn't actually want to construct the rest of the dish. But yet, there they are, creamed leeks on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, for me, this year is kind of bittersweet. You know, I lost my mom recently.
I'm sorry.
And Thanksgiving was definitely her favorite holiday. My mother was a noted eater and enabler of others eating. So part of me feels like I have to create the Thanksgiving of my childhood, which means making Pepperidge Farm stuffing with the addition of roasted chestnuts. And I'm going to have to invite people over to fight over who is capable of making the perfect roast chestnut without eating them.
Always a temptation.
Always a temptation. But then actually stuffing it into the bird. And my mother was a devotee of the risky method of putting in the turkey at 11 o'clock at night at 250 degrees and taking it out at 6 in the morning.
And she rocked the Adele Davis.
Yeah, the best turkey I've ever eaten in my life.
I've never had the courage to do that one.
It was so good every year. I couldn't wait to wake up and smell that smell permeating through the house and then starting to pick and have her hitting my hands.
So it was ready to go at 6 in the morning?
Ready to go at 6 in the morning, and then you take out the stuffing and you concentrate on all the side dishes. It was really an easy way to do it.
I admire her for doing it. I wish I could taste it without with having some kind of bacteriological certainty.
Well, happy Thanksgiving, Jonathan.
Happy Thanksgiving, Evan.
Jonathan Gold is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. I first met Loretta Barrett Oden in Idlewild during a competitive gathering of Native American chefs. Loretta has devoted her life to Native American foodways. She's a chef, a historian, a writer, and an Emmy Award-winning TV personality. And personally, I cannot wait to find out what's on her Thanksgiving table. Hi, Loretta.
Hi, Evan. How are you today?
Great. It's so nice to get to talk to you again.
Yes, it has been a while.
What was Thanksgiving like for you as a kid?
Very, very much like Thanksgiving is all across this country. Our family was so huge, and at that time I was, you know, really blessed to have grandparents and great-grandparents on both sides of the family. Plus, mom being from a large family, we had, you know, untold numbers of aunts and uncles and cousins and all of that. So we did several Thanksgiving. I ate turkey and dressing until I was, you know, a little round ball and had to sit on the sofa for the rest of the evening.
You know, it's interesting because I think some of us would be surprised to hear that Native Americans would even celebrate Thanksgiving. It seems to be so fraught with so much historical baggage.
Yes. I think that as we, you know, move forward in heightening people's awareness about the Native American people, and I think it comes with really identifying the food, you know, the origins of the foods that we eat that are connected with these different holidays, especially Thanksgiving. I love the story of Thanksgiving and the Mayflower and all of that, and I'm really conflicted on it a little bit because in my family, my mom's Indian side of the family, we're Potawatomi, but on my dad's side of the family, I'm a Mayflower descendant.
Wow. How American.
Yes, indeed.
Let's talk about the food a bit that you made. The menu that you make up now tends to be of pre-contact foods, meaning foods that were here in North America before the Europeans arrived. Can you share with us what some of these foods are?
Oh, absolutely, because a lot of people don't realize how many of the more familiar foods that we eat in this country and actually around the world have their origins in the Americas. Somewhere between Nunavut and Tierra del Fuego, these food origins from the New World have really impacted cuisines around the world. So if you take just the holiday of Thanksgiving that is celebrated in this country, the turkeys originated here. The corn originated here. The cranberries originated here. The sweet potatoes. So you dissect these different menus and you look at the ingredients used, and there's a definite thumbprint of Native America on it.
So I understand that sweet potatoes came from here, but not yams.
Correct. That's one of the big discussions. You know, sometimes in certain parts of the country here, we refer to sweet potatoes and yams. Yams are actually a totally different critter. They come from mostly Africa, Asia, but the sweet potato, which is actually kind of related to a morning glory, it's what is indigenous to the Americas, and our sweet potatoes are from the family of batatas. I love that word, batatas. And it's the one that is indigenous. In fact, the USDA has finally said that they must be labeled either sweet potatoes or yams because they are very different.
Now, you grew up in Oklahoma, but I know that in your work, you've traveled extensively collecting recipes and documenting traditions from all different Native American tribes. Are there any ingredients or techniques that really struck you as being shared by everyone?
Yes. Certainly the proliferation, you know, through the centuries. We're talking agriculture started in the Americas probably around, it's under discussion, 8,000 to 10,000 years ago. And the unbelievable trade routes, a lot of trade going on in the Americas. But the most common ingredients that I see are the corn, beans, and squash, the three sisters. You know, throughout the Americas, these three crops were very important to the diets of those people who were agrarian and pretty much stayed in one place. The more nomadic tribes that followed the buffalo herds would trade their meat, their buffalo meat and all of that, for those corn, beans, and squash, either seeds or the fruit of the seeds.
So given that there is this this push, this cultural pushback about what really happened during that era of contact, I'm sure that there are people who are more politically militant who find it difficult to swallow, let's say, that people would want to celebrate Thanksgiving. But you've said, which I find so deep, that when people have their mouths full of food, they'll listen.
Yes.
Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, when you speak to the politics, you know, I don't particularly care for politics of any any form from any people. I just think it's a big bunch of arguing, you know, and there's no resolution to the conflicts. So what I love to do is I love to cook really good food. And when the people are sitting at the table and they have their mouths full and they're going, this is really good, and I'll say, let me tell you about that dish. That came from such and such a place. You know, that's a sweet potato that had its origins here or there. The tomatoes, everything on your plate has a story. So I find that when I'm feeding people, it gives me a platform. I think the dining table, which is central to every culture. So I just think that when they're at the table, it gives you a pleasant way of explaining who we are, how diverse we are as Native people. You know, we're not just a bunch of Indians with feathers in our hair and running around that we're running around the country. We're still here, and we all have really great, very distinct traditions, and that's what I love to speak to people about while they're eating my food.
Thank you, Loretta, for coming and giving us a different perspective.
Oh, great, Evan. My pleasure. Anytime. Thank you.
Loretta Barrett Oden is a Native American culinary historian. She's also the food columnist for Native People's Magazine. You don't think I'm going to allow a Thanksgiving show without pie, do you? Yeah. Never going to happen. We've got dessert and sides coming up next.
This is producer Jillian Ferguson. You can connect with other food lovers on Evan's Facebook page, share photos, ask questions, and meet new friends. Search for Evan Kleinman on Facebook and click like.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. As vegetables move closer to the center of our plates, it's the Thanksgiving side dishes that command much of our attention. Caramelized Brussels sprouts, buttery mashed potatoes, roasted parsnips. Vegetables are no longer just the supporting role. Michael Anthony, chef partner at Gramercy Tavern and executive chef of Untitled in New York City, takes us through the entire vegetable alphabet in his new book, V is for Vegetable. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for having me today.
Oh, so happy to have you. It's a very beautiful book.
Thank you very much.
It's interesting to me that the time that you spent in Japan is filtered through a lot of these recipes in a very thoughtful way.
The primary focus of this book was to tell stories about either my introduction or discovery of vegetables, a personal take on cooking them, a helpful hint in the way of how a home cook should feel empowered to explore the inspiration that I find in cooking vegetables. So naturally, I looked to the places that as an adult, I started to fall in love with vegetables. And as a kid, I was a very picky eater and did not dream of being a chef. I came to that late in life after graduating from college. And when I started to travel, I fell in love with the connection to exploring new cultures. And one of the first places that I lived after school was Japan. I started cooking there professionally. I fell in love with the direct connection to following the changing seasons and the way in which people express that through the foods they eat.
One of the things that I find challenging about cooking vegetables during the fall season, and especially around Thanksgiving dinners, is the tendency to go very sweet. So many of the vegetables themselves have an underlying sweetness.
Oh, yeah. I grew up in the Midwest, and my grandmother, every Thanksgiving, would serve the dish, the baked sweet potatoes with marshmallows. And it is a real oddity of the dining world. In some ways, we looked forward to it because it was just such a strange thing that we would never eat at any other time of the year. But it's interesting because in some ways, used with discretion, a little hint of sweetness can really create a magical flavor combination with braising greens that are quite minerally or root vegetables that have a noticeable turnipy quality. Things like rutabaga really take well to just a little hint of sweetness. But I think that's all in the hand of the cook.
One of the things that one of your recipes that I found kind of really interesting because of its wild card ingredient, mozzarella, is the vegetarian winter squash stuffing. Because I think about, okay, vegetarian winter squash stuffing, that is interesting because you can serve it as a vegetarian main course, but then the addition of mozzarella. So take me through this dish. Why?
Well, V is for Vegetables is all about cooking at home. It is a pat on the back for cooks who are courageous enough to get in there and put their reputations on the line, which we do every time we set foot in the kitchen cooking for our family and friends and even for ourselves in some way. So I wanted to show people that in thinking about cooking any dish, and especially vegetables, it's helpful to think about texture and it's helpful to think about appeal. There are no rules. We have to allow ourselves to think about pleasurable eating. I love the health benefits of eating vegetables. I have three daughters, so I think carefully about how we're introducing them to eating and to discovering new flavors and hopefully creating a wide palate, a range of flavors that their palate is used to. I'm a dad, so I'll resort to anything to make these dishes appealing. And I think that sometimes the soft, fluffy quality of something somewhat ubiquitous like mozzarella or tofu plays a role in a dish that allows it to be more substantial and ultimately a little bit more approachable.
Another challenge that I often find during the Thanksgiving table is to vary texture because so much of the classic meal is a similar soft texture. And one of my favorite vegetables, I have to say, is kohlrabi. And I really love it raw.
I do too. It's a vegetable that a lot of people are unfamiliar with. And just because it grows in an interesting way where it throws off several stems, it looks a bit like a UFO to people who are not familiar with it. But what's really surprising is how tender the skin is. It's very easy to peel, whether you use a paring knife or a peeler. Kohlrabi in particular, I like it when it's around a baseball size, just a little bit bigger. It remains tender all the way through, very moist, very easy to slice, whether you're cutting paper thin slices or with a knife quartering it.
How do you like to dress it when you're using it raw?
Well, really, it takes very well to any light vinaigrette. So I think that interesting oils sometimes help. So a hazelnut, a pistachio, or a walnut oil can go really well. I think it's such a discreet flavor that I try to go really light with the choice of vinegar. And sometimes citrus juice is the way to go. It tends to take on any flavor that you pair with it. But there's another interesting thing. So as much as I like to slice it and eat it raw, it's so tempting to put it in a pan and caramelize it. It browns really easily. And in some ways, the way, as versatile as a potato is, kohlrabi can act the same way.
Okay, so you said the word potato. So we have to go there. And you have a recipe for a mashed potato that has a variation that I think is kind of genius, which is the addition of walnuts.
Versatility is the name of the game with potatoes. The potatoes form a background and play a supporting role to capturing and promoting that lightly toasted quality of fresh walnut oil. Being here in California, we were able to just taste some of this year's fresh press, and it is an amazing connector to the place in which you're cooking. Most of these dishes are intended to help people also think about finding inspiration in the changing season and creating a sense of connection with the place they're cooking.
Whose walnut oil did you taste?
That was a company called Tourangelle, which does a really nice job of pressing beautiful oils. We tasted a version, a very similar thought process, at the very end of a wonderful meal at Meadowood. So a long tasting menu, extremely delicious, light flavors, and dessert was served in a bowl that was carved out of one piece of walnut wood. It was a roasted date puree with walnut oil. And it was gorgeous and, you know, utter simplicity. And so sometimes it's that gesture, even at home, especially at home, we can treat ourselves to things that are quite special and lean on simplicity. We don't always need 10 or 12 or 15 ingredients to make an ordinary night turn into a celebration.
What a fun conversation. Thank you so much.
I appreciate you inviting me today.
Michael Anthony is chef partner at Gramercy Tavern and is the executive chef of Untitled in New York City. We've got two kohlrabi recipes from his new book, B is for Vegetables. Check them out on the Good Food blog, of course. If you want Thanksgiving vegetable inspiration, look no further than our local farmers markets. Laura Avery's here now with her weekly report.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. The whole farmers market community is getting excited about our big annual pre-Thanksgiving market next Wednesday. And of course, high on everyone's list is the perfect sweet potato or yam to put on the family table. I'm talking now with Greg Nauta, who's an organic farmer from Atascadero. And Greg is sort of famous, not only for the beef and the other things he grows, but for his amazingly sweet potatoes or yams. First of all, Greg, let's talk about what is a yam and what is a sweet potato.
Technically, by genus and species, they're all sweet potatoes. What they tend to refer to as a yam is the sweet potato that tends to be orange on the inside and creamier texture. And they just call that a yam, even though technically a true yam is more equatorial and grows in the tropics more.
And yours are the dark orange yam looking one. And are they dark orange flesh on the inside?
Yeah, they're a nice orange, deep color. Even though there are varieties that are purple, there's white ones, there's light orange ones. I tend to really like the one that tends to get nice and creamy and has a really sweet flavor.
And is it what we would call the garnet?
Yeah, it is a garnet variety, but it's actually crossed with something else.
I think you're the only one that grows these.
I don't know. As far as I know, this is a variety I've been growing for about 10, 12 years now.
Yeah, and people do weigh in and they do say that they prefer yours over many of the others just because of that special uniqueness. How long are they going to last? And when we get them, do we need to refrigerate them?
Sweet potatoes actually like temperatures around 50 to 60 degrees. They don't like it cold in the refrigerator. It'll actually cause them to spoil. So room temperature is the best. Warmer is better than colder. This time of year, they're coming real fresh out of the ground, so they have a good shelf life of at least 3-4 weeks.
And you probably don't ever want to put them in a plastic bag.
Only for transportation. Once you get home, either open the bag or take them out of the bag.
So, Greg, at your household, do you cook the yams and serve them on Thanksgiving?
Yeah, we kind of mix it up from year to year. It's not always a traditional casserole or anything like that, but a lot of times I like mine just as a baked potato, and then I can do what I want with it. Sometimes if you take like just a couple drops of orange juice and put it on it, it flavors it nice with a little butter. They don't need a lot of sweetness, but if you do want sweetness, I recommend a maple syrup flavor and just go easy on it because they're naturally sweet.
Okay, sounds fabulous. Thanks.
All right, thank you.
That was Greg Nauta. He's an organic farmer from Atascadero. He does have this special, unique variety of a garnet yam, and it's just super delicious. People really enjoy them. We're going to try to get some great intel on how to make a perfect sweet potato pie for Thanksgiving right now. And I'm happy to be talking to Nicole Rucker, who is the chef and co-owner of Kofax Coffee and makes pies for Bledsoe's as well. And yep. Nicole, you have some great ideas to make sweet potato pies for Thanksgiving. Tell us what kind of sweet potatoes you like to use and what's the technique.
Right. So first I'll talk about the technique, and it is something that I was inspired to make after visiting South Carolina. We ate at, you know, many places over 5 days, but the one dish that stood out was from Martha Lou's. It's a soul food restaurant still run by Martha Lou. I don't even know how old she is. I wouldn't dare to say it. Mm-hmm. But she's still up and around and cooking, and she made us this sweet potato pie that had a top crust. And it was not a pureed sweet potato custard. It was just like candied sweet potatoes between two layers of crust, and it was the most beautiful, elegant pie I've ever seen. The technique is that you just take really beautiful young sweet potatoes, the little ones, not the big honkers, because they have too much fiber. So you take little guys, peel them, and then candy them in a syrup, kind of like you could do it in your crock pot. I feel like this is like a good housekeeping recipe from the 80s or something. But you just season them with cinnamon and sugar, and we put a piece of ginger in there, a little bit of water. Just simmer the sweet potatoes or do them in the crock pot till they're tender. And then at the end, you add butter. and kind of mash up a couple of them, but leave some whole chunks. It's like really rustic and open to interpretation. And then you just put it in between two pastry crusts and bake it. And it needs no thickener because of the starch from the sweet potatoes. And then if you need to put marshmallows on top of the pastry crust, like, go for it. Let's put marshmallows on top of it.
I love the fact that you got this sweet potato pie in South Carolina in the middle of the summer. So clearly they're not waiting till Thanksgiving to eat their sweet potatoes.
No, and I'm pretty sure they were canned sweet potatoes. But we'll give Martha Lou a pass because she's a sweet, sweet old woman. But I found that if I just simmered the sweet potatoes until they were barely tender and kind of mashed up the smaller chunks to give it some like mushy viscosity and put it in a raw pastry crust, painted the top with cream and put some sugar on it, put it in the oven, baked it for an hour, I had something really beautiful.
Okay, so today at COFAX, you're going to be doing a pie instruction and helpful advice session. When does that take place?
Yeah, so tonight and Sunday night at COFAX Coffee on Fairfax, I'm going to be there selling slices of pie until 8. It's all the pies that we sell for Thanksgiving that we're offering at Bledsoe's Barbecue and at COFAX Coffee, and Dinosaur Coffee sells our pies as well. I'll be there. I'll bring recipes. If you have questions, this is a good chance to talk about it in person and eat pie and drink coffee. I'm kind of thinking of it as like a pie salon, you know, like let's just talk about all the stuff that people call into shows for, or like, you know, just like rap about it. It's cool.
That sounds really, really fun, especially when you can eat the pies at the same time.
Yeah, eat the pies too. That's right. You get to preview the pie and then either try and make it yourself or buy one from me and pretend like you made it.
Sounds fun. Well, thanks, Nicole.
Thank you. Nice to speak with you.
So great to have you here. That was Nicole Rucker, chef and co-owner of COFAX Coffee, and she also makes pies for Bledsoe's. She will be answering all your pie questions this weekend at COFAX. The Wednesday market before Thanksgiving is our busiest market of the year, and we are going to try very hard to get the streets closed off and ready to start earlier than normal. We will blow the horn when we get everything set in place, and we're hoping to start well before 8 o'clock. But if you come early, do wait for that horn to blow before you start shopping. Can't wait to see you here. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
We've got a recipe for Nicole's sweet potato pie on the Good Food blog. If you missed any part of today's show, do not fret, because you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's smartphone apps. Do go ahead and check out the Good Food blog. All of the Thanksgiving recipes you heard about today are there, plus many, many more from all our past years. Thanks to everyone who works on Good Food. That's Jillian, Camelia, Laurel, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.